this meeting because it is 10 o'clock, and then extend a warm welcome to all honorable members of the State Committee on Trade and Competition, Employment and Labour Tourism.
Recording in progress.
And also GTIC. The purpose of today's meeting is continuation of the public hearing on both the two bills, Performance Protection Amendment Bill and also the Copyright Amendment Bill. This is our third leg of the public hearing. And therefore, it's going to be another long day, but I think what is quite critical, the issue of public consultation and public involvement in all legislation that the Parliament intends, and is quite imperative and very important. But more than that, also, it is important that we also extend the word of greetings to all our participants that are on the platform. As you can see, that is the lineup for today, and understand that the presenter that's going to start is already on the platform. But maybe just to check with Madia, are there any apologies that you are showing?
Yes, Chief, I can maybe just go through the members who are present. We've got yourself, Honourable Mashuri, Honourable Mamrahana, Honourable Prathasit, and Honourable Matavula. And then we have also apologies from Honourable Dango and Honourable Boshoff, who's going into surgery today. She said she's going to try and come in later, but given the fact that she's going into surgery today, maybe she might not be able to join us. And then we've also got standing apologies from our chairperson, Honourable Hai, and then also Mr. Honourable Lansman. In terms of our colleagues that we are present, we've got my co-committee secretary, Mr. Nizulu, our committee assistant, Mr. Bazir, and Edward Khanumerva as well, our parliamentary legal advisor.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's not
support. I'm also present, Aplin.
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, Honorable Aplini.
Is present today, announcing himself.
Oh, as I said, because the gadget is not marked, which was important for him to mark his presence. Thank you, Honorable Aplini, thank you, Honorable Mishodi. Even Honorable Dango said he was going to undergo a procedure, so that's also wishing well in that, and also Honorable Pasha. Honorable members and also the PMG and also the media team on the platform and the public, let's without any waste of time then invite Dr. Sanya some. Tara and also Professor Peter from the School of Law of Northwest University. Dr. Sanya is from the University of Vets. So without any waste of time, this team, I understand, will be representing various academic institutions that were listed on the program. So without any waste of time, the floor is yours. And you are welcome.
Many thanks, Chairperson Moimang. I trust that you can hear and see me.
Yes, yes, we can see you. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm about to share my screen. So just bear with me for one moment. Thank you. Honourable members, I hope you can see my screen as well.
Yes, we can see the screen.
Fantastic. Then I will begin my presentation. Honourable Chairperson, Honourable members of the NCOP Select Committee on Trade, Industry, Economic Development, Small Business Development, Tourism, Employment and Labour, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before this committee. My name is Dr. Sanya Samtani. I am a senior researcher at the Mandela Institute at the University of Wits. And I'm an expert in copyright and human rights law in international and domestic law, India and South Africa specifically. I appear here along with my colleague, Professor Klaus Bethel, and I speak on behalf of a coalition of copyright and constitutional law experts from these specific institutions. Their names are on the screen for your reference. We have also submitted a joint academic opinion that's in our written submissions that provides detailed textual recommendations on proposed amendments that we make, suggestions that we make to the committee to amend the CAB. Our submissions in this instance build on two previous opinions which were submitted to the National Assembly Portfolio Committee on Trade, Industry and Competition. And those opinions have been published and can be accessed at the link on your screen. That's also been detailed in our written submissions in case people are interested to have a look at our previous submissions. Moving quickly on then to the context in this current case. First of all, this process of copyright reform has been a long process to reform this Apartheid Era Act, 14 years approximately, starting in 2009. And this particular iteration of the bill has taken 6 years to get to this stage with extensive public participation. Now, the Constitutional Court in its recent judgment of 21 September 2022 noted that it is imperative that people living with disabilities, particularly visual and print disabilities, rectify their current unconstitutional situation. Now, I will be talking a little bit more about what that situation is that has been created by the current Apartheid Era Act. And I will also talk a little bit about the Constitutional Court judgment. But suffice to say at this current stage that the court gave Parliament approximately 24 months from September 2022 to fix the act, and there are only 18 months left, and so the reform is currently urgent. Now, in particular, the Constitutional Court judgment noted that copyright reform to ensure that people with disabilities have access to accessible format works and are able to convert works into accessible formats is urgent. The court read in a particular provision into the current Apartheid Era Copyright Act in order to fix the current discriminatory position, and I will talk about that more in my submissions. The third point of context is that the Falam Commission documented the full extent of how iconic South African artists are dying in poverty, like Solomon Linda, for example, due to the lack of regulation specifically of collecting societies and copyright management organizations. We submit that the CAB seeks to fix this by regulating collecting societies in sections 22B to F, and also to ensure that artists get fair remuneration for their work by providing protection against unenforceable contractual terms in section 39B of the CAB, and we submit that the CAB succeeds in doing so. Another point of important context is that COVID-19 has exacerbated existing inequalities as well as the digital divide. We are currently living in the aftermath of almost 2 years of lockdown where we saw inadequate access to educational materials as well as to internet infrastructure, which has delayed the realization of the right to education for all. The Copyright Amendment Bill aims to fix that and also provides for clear direction on the preservation of cultural heritage by libraries, archives, museums and galleries so that we do not see a repeat of the grave loss priceless cultural heritage in the 2020 that we saw in the 2021 UCT fires. The final point of context here is that South Africa is seeking to participate in the fourth industrial revolution, but unfortunately cannot do so with its current copyright laws because its current copyright act, the Apartheid Era Act, refers to obsolete technologies like facsimiles, for example, that are rarely used in educational context and in other contexts, and also continues to prevent the use of new technologies for cutting-edge research like data mining. My colleague, Professor Bethel, will talk a little bit more about that in his recommendations at the end of this my presentation. In sum, we submit that the CAB promotes innovation and it also future-proofs the law in bringing South Africa into the fourth industrial revolution and the digital era. So a short word on the CAB provisions that we do not comment on. There are certain provisions that we do not comment on as we submit that they require no change. In our submission, we are mindful of the constitutional imperative that all organs of state must respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights. This also extends to Parliament's lawmaking function across all subject matter, including copyright. At the same time, we understand that the Bill of Rights is not absolute and that Parliament may limit rights through a law of general application, such as a CAB, potentially, under certain conditions. Where Parliament exercises such a discretion to limit rights, it must do so in a way that the limitations are reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society and can thus pass constitutional muster. We submit that this particular approach, one that considers the impact of statutory copyright on the Bill of Rights, has been correctly taken by the National Assembly, and that considered as a whole, an appropriate balance has been struck between users and creators in the bill. We adopt the same approach in our submissions. We also submit that the provisions that we do not comment on, for example, sections 12A to D, section 19D, section 6A, 7A to F, 8A and 9A, all fulfill important rights in the Bill of Rights and are also in line with established international and comparative law, and therefore strike a fair balance as well. Moving now to the next part of my presentation to explain how we will be presenting our recommendations. So I will present amendments that we propose related to people with disabilities and the realization of constitutional rights. My colleague, Professor Klaus Bethe, will present amendments relating to the right to research and fair use, as well as technological protection measures. Moving swiftly on to the first set of amendments that we propose in our written submissions. We propose that in order to avoid any interpretation that could lead to its unconstitutionality, Section 19D specifically be amended to comply with the Constitutional Court's judgment in the Blind Essay versus Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition. I introduced the case in my introduction, but I'm going to continue now to explain it in a little more detail. In that case, the court held that the current Copyright Act of 1978 was unconstitutional to the extent that it discriminated against people with visual and print disabilities and violated their rights to equality, dignity, education, culture, and language. The court's ruling crucially turned on the fact that people with visual and print disabilities had to first ask for permission or authorization from the copyright holder, while people without such disabilities did not have to do so. To fix this, the court read in Section 13A that in effect removed this requirement and permitted explicitly accessible format shifting. Our submissions on Section 19D aim to align the CAB with this court-crafted remedy and therefore ensure the CAB's constitutionality. In specific, we recommend that the NCOP amend the CAB to ensure that Section 19D subsection 1 is operational immediately without the need for regulations. There are several paragraphs in the Constitutional Court judgment that denote that this is the constitutional case. Paragraphs 102, 108, and 109 specifically of the Concord judgment make it clear that people's rights to equality and non-discrimination, particularly blind people's rights, cannot wait any longer and require immediate redress. Second, we recommend that Section 19D2A be amended to remove barriers to sharing accessible format copies among the disability community, in line with the court's ruling that people with visual and print disabilities must have the greatest latitude in order to access these materials to the same level as people without disabilities. And finally, we recommend that the reference to people with all disabilities be retained in Section 19D to avoid the need for further litigation from other disability groups that are analogous to the disability groups that did in fact initiate the blind essay litigation. This is in line not only with the Bill of Rights, but also with the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities that South Africa ratified in 2007 and therefore has obligations to domestically put into place. I move now to the next set of amendments relating to people with disabilities, and those concern specifically the technological protection measures. Now, in relation to the technological protection measures, as I had mentioned previously, the Constitutional Court judgment turned on the requirement of authorization that limited people with disabilities' capacity to access works at the same level as others. Now, the provision that we have highlighted on the screen, as well as in our written submission, Section 28P2, that section reinstates that requirement of authorization that the Constitutional Court held to be unconstitutional and runs the risk of further adversely impacting people with disabilities and discriminating against them. I'll give you a concrete example. For instance, if a blind person were to buy a book on an e-book reader, they would necessarily need to remove the digital locks that exist that tie that e-book to that reader in order to convert it into a format that is accessible for them to actually read it. Now, that involves device shifting, and this provision effectively prevents such a thing, even for the purposes of anti-discrimination, even for the purposes of realizing the rights of people with visual and print disabilities. So we submit in our written submissions as well that that particular requirement be deleted in order to comply with the Constitutional Court judgment. Now, in the event that Parliament does not seek to delete such a provision, we recommend that Parliament consider carefully the impact of this provision on people with visual and print disabilities and amend it in a way to ensure that the TPMs or the digital locks do not prevent people with disabilities from actually reading works to which they have lawful access, whether through a library or whether through the market. That brings me to the end of my part of the submissions. I now hand over to my colleague, Professor Klaus Bethel. Thank you very much for your attention. Prof. Bethel, over to you, please.
Prof. It's Prof on the...
He's just been admitted to the platform now, okay? I think he was disconnected, but I've just admitted him back onto the platform.
Okay, good. I also have a low shading, so I might be very dark for the team to see me. Prof?
I'm better.
Welcome, Prof. The floor is yours.
I just got back to the room. We have low shading in Potter's room, but I'm just back. So, honourable members of the committee, I suppose, Sonia, it's my turn now.
It is, Klaus. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Sonia. Now, this team welcomes the retention of the fair use provision as it is at the moment. So, of course, the provision permits fair uses for purposes such as, and then it mentions purposes including research. So we welcome the retention of this provision. However, we would recommend a certain amendment. I'll come to that in a second. Now, our current law envisages fair dealing, not fair use, but there is no difference in principle between these two constructs in as far as the fair dealing or fair use test, you know, the fairness test is concerned. The only difference really is that in the case of the fair use provision, you've got this these words saying purposes such as, and the importance of that is that it leaves open future conceivable uses which could not be foreseen by the drafters of the legislation, and though thus makes it unnecessary to amend the law in the future for certain purposes such as computational methods of analysis, you know, which cannot be foreseen at the moment of drafting. Now, we know, of course, that these computational methods of analysis are important, and we would at this point rather recommend their inclusion. Although they might be covered by the fair use as it is, we recommend their inclusion on the one hand just because of legal security, also because these provisions are so important at this point in time. And then also, you know, if you compare the South African fair use provision in the bill with the US one, then there are differences. It's usually said that the US provision would cover text and data mining, which is what we are essentially talking about. But the South African provision, as envisaged now, really must be read together with the fair dealing provisions and therefore might be constructed a bit more narrowly. So it is advisable to just include the phrase, including informational analysis. Sonia, the next slide, please. So this is a publication, this is drawn from a publication which recently appeared in the prestigious journal Science, showing how copyright laws around the world are prepared for text and data mining. So here we can see the US with its fair use provision is prepared. Those countries shown in brown here are not prepared at all, and all the others are somewhere in the middle. So you see South Africa at the moment with its current Copyright Act is blue. We know that at the moment there is just a fair dealing provision envisaging research for private purposes and research. So this is very narrow. So clearly there's a need for the fair use provision encompassing also research, but it should also, from our perspective, include computational methods, meaning text and data mining. Just to quickly say what text and data mining is, it is the use of software computers to search vast amounts of data within seconds to make comparisons of similarities, dissimilarities, correlations for the purposes of research. So text and data mining was crucial in the process of developing COVID vaccines. South African law obviously should be prepared for this. Now text and data mining needs access to copyrighted materials, and it must be ensured that that is possible, of course. Sanya, the next slide. So just to confirm the importance more generally of the fair use clause in the current bill, how important it is from two perspectives, from that of development, the right to development, and on the other hand, that of international human rights protection. So this slide here, more particularly on the right to development. So the 2002 report of the UK property rights makes an interesting statement, and this is not really a commission of UK experts, but it was internet experts, including, for example, Professor Carlos Correa, who heads the South Centre in Geneva now, representing the interests of the Global South. So there he says, or the report says, it is important for developing countries to be able to maintain or adopt broad exemptions for educational research and library uses. So this is really what the fair use provision does. We must understand that there is no one size fits all in intellectual property law. It always depends on your economic context. If levels of protection are too low, there will be no innovation and therefore also no dissemination. But if levels of protection are too high, there will be no dissemination in the first instance, and therefore also no innovation following. And in the case of poorer countries, developing countries such as South Africa, it is especially the access aspect that is so important. Before there is no access, there cannot be any creation. And for access, you need lower protection of intellectual property rights. Of course, this also applies to copyright. Yes, that is the slide dealing with international human rights law. So obviously you cannot read the three-step test of international copyright law in a restrictive fashion without having regard to international human rights law. So the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which is also an agreement to which South Africa is a party, must be taken into consideration when understanding the three-step test of international copyright law. And here we've got in Article 15.1b the provision that there is a right to enjoy the benefits of scientific progress and its applications. So this means the importance of research to create these benefits. Also for that reason, the fair use provision is important and its inclusion of research and, as we recommend, the provision on text and data mining. Sanya, I think let's go to the next slide. Just to again confirm both the developmental and the human rights perspective, this balanced interpretation of the three-step test declaration was drafted by the Max Planck Institute, inviting recommended copyright scholars from around the world. And it emphasizes, if you especially look here at point 3A, it says, open-ended limitations and exceptions are not prevented by the three-step test. So the fair use provision is definitely legitimate under the three-step test. also here in point six, emphasizing that in constructing limitations and exceptions, it's important to have regard to the interests deriving from human rights and fundamental freedoms and other public interests, specifically referring here to also to scientific progress, that is research. Next slide, Sanya, and that is now the last point of our recommended changes. Again, first referring to the report of the UK Commission, where it says that developing countries should ensure that their IP legislation and procedures emphasize to the maximum possible extent enforcement of IP law through administrative action and through the civil rather than the criminal justice system. This particularly concerns the provisions of the bill, which at the moment envisage criminal liability for cases where a person makes, imports, sells devices that may be used to circumvent technical protection measures. In our view, this should be changed. It concerns sections 27.5B and 280 of the Copyright Act, which should be changed to make provision at the most for administrative or civil liability, you know, like claiming damages, fines, interdicts, but no criminal action. And the reasons for this are, again, there's two important reasons. The one is that criminal enforcement simply is very expensive, and criminal enforcement really requires the practicalities to do that. But much more important is the fact that criminal law is really the last measure a society should use for regulating its affairs. It's a question whether there is societal consensus on the use of criminal measures. And I can assure you, if you were to do a survey among the public whether criminal law should be used, it would be quite clear that there is no moral consensus on the use of criminal liability, but also to say that this is supported by international law. If you look at the TRIPS agreement, there is a provision which says that criminal measures may be used to enforce IP law, but only if the conduct is willful and if the infringements occur on a commercial scale. Also, if you look at the World Copyright Treaty, it does not refer to any criminal liability in connection with a circumvention of technical protection measures. In fact, it allows the circumvention in those cases where you wish to make use of lawful rights that you have in terms of legislation, you know, for example, rights under the fair use provision. And just as an example here on this slide, we see how the attempt in the European Union to introduce criminal measures in 2006 actually failed. So the EU envisaged that there be criminal sanctions for all intentional infringements of an intellectual property right on a commercial scale. And the European Parliament rejected this, saying that there must be a specific provision making sure that there will not be criminal liability for any private uses for personal and not-for-profit purposes. And it is also important to understand that when we say that there may only be liability when there is infringement on a commercial scale, then commercial scale really refers to a commercial scale of a market relevant magnitude. So this means that if you make devices that can be used to circumvent TPM's technical protection measures, then if these are used by 100 or 200 or 300 people and even cause economic damage, then this is not a damage of a commercial scale, assuming market relevant magnitudes. So Sanya, then the last slide, which basically summarizes our position, sections 27.5B and 280 be replaced by civil liability provisions, preferably if Parliament really wants to stick to criminal sanctions, then very clearly make sure that only for willful conduct on a commercial scale of a market relevant magnitude. Thank you, honourable members of the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Prof. for the presentation together with Sanya. We know that members are experiencing load shedding, as it has been indicated by Honorable Matevila. Just to check from members whether there are any clarifying questions that they would want to pose to the presentation from the Coalition of Cited Universities, as led by Dr. Sanya and also Professor Abita. Honourable members, I guess your presentation was quite succinct, Prof, and well understood. maybe just one from my side. the fair deal and fair use. You raise a point that there is not a major difference between the Copyright Amendment Bill, as captured in the Copyright Amendment Bill, and also the U.S. What you say with regards to the view that suggests that countries that we have a history with are not using a fair use but fair dealing?
Yes, that is what I said. You will notice, for example, that the UK, you know, South African copyright law was very much oriented at English law, but also if you look at European Union law, they envisage systems of fair dealing. And in order to cater now for cases of text and data mining, both these systems have to amend the law to make provision for that. If you have a fair use provision, like the US or hopefully South Africa soon, then cases such as text and data mining might be covered by the fair use provision. It's not 100% sure that they would be. There are perhaps differences of opinion, but much more likely to be covered than if you're just working with fair dealing provisions. And that is the reason why we said rather include it expressly to make sure it is there, because we know how important it is. We have seen in the COVID crisis how important research and the search of vast amounts of information is necessary to come up with solutions. And without such a provision, such searches might potentially infringe copyright. So that is the difference. The difference does not really concern the fairness inquiry. And the fair use provision, in a sense, is just another version of the three-step test itself. If you look at the treatise by Martin Senftleben, who wrote like a monumental work on the three-step test, there he says that the fair use test, in a sense, is just another way of expressing the three-step test. Just with the advantage that if you've got a fair use provision, you might look at those jurisdictions that work with fair use to see how they are dealing with it. Not to say that you must necessarily adopt what they are doing, but at least you've got a body of knowledge available. Whereas working with a three-step test is like really working with a few sentences, and that is all you have.
Honourable Chairperson, if I may also add a response to that.
Yes, Sonia.
Thank you very much, Chair. So I just want to draw your attention to the CAB, specifically Section 12A, Subsection B. Section 12A, Subsection B specifically lists the factors that must be taken into account when filling out the content of fair use. So, for example, if one were to add in future an additional use that's not listed under 12A subsection A, then the following factors in 12A subsection B must be taken into account. For example, the nature of the work, the amount and substantiality of the part of the work that's affected in relation to the whole work, the purpose of the use, the character of the use, whether the use serves a different purpose from the original work, whether that purpose is of a commercial nature or if it's of a non-profit nature, and finally, and probably most importantly, the substitution effect on the market. So if it has a great substitution effect on the market, then it is likely that that use is not going to be considered fair. So just to respond to the anxieties around American-style fair use being broad, the South African version of fair use that the CAB adopts is a hybrid version. So it has specific factors that are enshrined in legislation to prevent any sort of overbroad inclusion or to prevent any sort of effect on the market. I'll stop there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Sanya. Just in terms of the, because when you started, you put more emphasis in terms of the rise in the bill of rights, and particularly the implications of the latest Concord judgment. But the question that I want to pose, particularly with regard to the concern that has been raised around the arbitrary nature of the two bills, particularly its impact in terms of the rights protected by the rights protected to the authors, given the nature of a constitution like the supremacy of the constitution, given the fact that any act, administrative act, or a decision taken by government, whether in relation to the effect that will have on the copyright holder, can we take comfort in the fact that any decision that has to be taken by government, it has to be rational, and therefore the concern around Section 251, which relates to the protection of the of property, because copyright by its nature is an integral part of the intellectual property. Are you of the view that there is sufficient built-in mechanism in our constitution to be able to allay our fears?
Thank you, Chair. I will respond and then I will see if Klaus has also an additional response. So Section 25.1 specifically has been interpreted by courts as a right against arbitrary deprivation of property. And so the specific test there is, there's a seven-step test that the FNB judgment in the Constitutional Court developed. Now, if we apply each of those legs of the test, we can see that the first question is to determine whether the interests at stake actually do constitute a form of constitutionally protected property. Now, that question has been left open with regard to copyright, but let's assume even if it is, then we move on to the arbitrary, we move on to checking whether there has been a deprivation of any incidence of ownership or enjoyment of that particular property by the owner of the property. And let's even assume that. Let's assume that there's been some degree of deprivation without conceding. Then the test is an arbitrariness test. Now, the Constitutional Court has developed this arbitrariness test in quite a lot of detail, and there are many different steps that must be undertaken to prove that something was indeed an arbitrary deprivation. Now, one of those tests is the test of sufficient reason, and the Concord has described in that test of sufficient reason in its jurisprudence over the years that where a particular deprivation serves to give effect to a right in the Bill of Rights, it's very unlikely for it to be held to be arbitrary in the first place, because there's already sufficient reason that can be demonstrated. There's quite a long analysis that can be done on this, but I'll stop there for now. And I would just like to highlight that there are several rights that I highlighted, that we have highlighted in our written submissions, and I can list them as well. So with regard to artists and creators, it's their right to a decent standard of living that is protected by the CAB. It is a right to live and work, a right to their livelihood, and particularly in the South African constitution, it is a right to choose their profession and trade under Section 22 of the constitution that is being promoted by the CAB. With regard to people with disabilities, it is their right against discrimination. It is their right to equality, right to dignity, right to access cultural life, and the right to access language. It is also the right to access education. And that also applies to students. It applies to people like Klaus and me as academics also, in terms of our right to impart education as well as to receive education, including lifelong education. And there are several others. For example, the right to education is also protected by the cultural heritage protections in the CAB, particularly because it ensures that libraries are able to better protect their collections. And we know that all of us access books largely through libraries. Again, I'll stop there. I'm happy to answer further questions. And I yield again to Klaus if you have any further responses to the question posed by the chair.
Thank you, Sanya. You answered well, and I actually see our time is actually also over. I don't want to, you know, rob the time of subsequent speakers. Perhaps just one last word to always remember, always also if it concerns the protection of property. Although this provision, of course, is very important in the Constitution, also not forget to look at what international law says. The International Covenant on, you know, the International Covenants on Human Rights actually do not include a provision on the protection of the right to property is important to note. And another consideration is that all human rights ultimately have a basis in human dignity. So the central criterion always is to ask, if we protect property, this or that property, to what extent is that necessary to protect human dignity? And to what extent is it actually not really necessary? To that extent, the protection of property becomes a matter not really so much, in my view, of the Constitution, but of the rest of the legal order. And this is important for constitutionally weighing the importance of interests, you know, access to knowledge, education, science, versus the property interests of others. And perhaps also last point, not to open another can of worms, but important way of protecting the interests of authors and creators, which is very essential because that is a human right also in terms of international law. A strategic instrument is the use of contract law. Contract law between in the sphere of copyright between publishers and authors, and we should not neglect that point. That is the point where authors and creators make their money, not subsequently losing perhaps a market by others just using perhaps a bit of too much information or a bit too less. Thank you.
Thank you, Prof, and thank you, Dr. Sanya, for the presentation, and also a word of gratitude on behalf of the Select Committee for honoring our invite to make an input to this process, which is quite critical. And have a wonderful day.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sanya. Thank you, Prof. Honorable members, we will now move to the next presenter, which will be Ms. Crystal Burkholz-Kati. The floor is yours. Crystal, how are you?
Fine, thanks, and you?
I'm good.
Great.
The floor is yours.
Great, thank you. I just want to make sure I can't see myself, so you can see me, is that correct?
Yes, we can see you.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you. I don't have a full list of everyone in attendance, so if I do miss somebody, I'll maybe just make a global welcome. Thank you so much for having me on, to all the honourable members. Pleasure to submit my perspective on the amendments. I'm not sure if my slides are there. It's not important if they aren't. I'll start with just saying who I am. So I'm a musician. So I represent, the concerns and the views of independent musicians, up and coming musicians, maybe even musicians starting out. So that sort of level of musicians. I have worked with, recording artists as well. So I've sort of seen a bit of a spectrum of the music industry. But in my personal capacity, I write music, I record music, I play music, and I've also, since lockdown, started making music videos and educational content as well. So that's kind of the perspective I'm talking from. Going back to the idea of lockdown, I think for many, many musicians in my sort of corner, as it were, we found that digital royalties and digital income was very important because our livelihood dried up. And many musicians that I know took a crash course in learning to do videos, learning what royalties they could access, other ways of making money in music. And as a result, where the copyright law really touches the musicians in terms of this part, digital and royalty income, is quite important for musicians, I think, more than ever. And I think there are a lot of musicians quite concerned about how this will impact them going forward. I think content, the online space is a big ocean. And it's very easy for anybody to put up content. As you all know, you can take a cell phone recording and have something go viral in minutes. But my experience, here we go, thank you. We can I run the slides? There we go. So that was just an introduction of who I am. Mm-hmm. The next slide, sorry. That was just so that you have an idea of some of what I've done. And we can go to the next slide, please. This was an interesting one I just wanted to show you. So I started doing YouTube videos, and I just wanted to make the point that my viewership really, really did value the time and effort that I put into making good quality videos, especially the ones that were of educational content. So this one is an educational one, and it just shows you that they trusted me because I put quality content out. There was a lot of other content available, but because they could see that mine was quality and a time and thought was put into it as an educational video, they trusted that I was giving them the correct version and educational construct that they needed. Okay, we can go to the next slide. Importance of digital income to the independent artist. So as I was mentioning, musicians are quite concerned about their digital and copyright income streams as part of their earnings. I think many musicians earn money from various sources, from live performance to contract work to online and digital and copyright income streams. So it is one of the income streams, but as I mentioned, it's a very important one for musicians. Just to go into some of the costs from someone who's done it, to make a 3-minute song, where are my notes here? To make a simple 3-minute song that you can upload in a week's time on Spotify, you are looking at anywhere from 1,000 Rand to 10,000 Rand and up just to produce a song. That would include the recording, any session work, getting it onto various platforms, and that is before you've done any marketing on the song. It's a point that I think is often overlooked in a content-rich environment, one has to market something to stand out in the crowd. So marketing costs can be as little as $1 a day to get something onto an international radio station or even local radio station will cost 7,000 rand per song. So the input costs for a 3-minute song are not negligible. And that's before you've made a music video and maybe other aspects that you want to add to this. So I would like, from my own perspective, and I think musicians I've spoken to in this regard, we aim to recoup at least our cost from our endeavors and hopefully make a profit, of course. And we work in a constrained environment in terms of incomes, and that would be the various platforms that take Spotify, Deezer, any of those platforms, iTunes. They often pay as little as a fraction of a cent per play per song. So it's not like musicians are making a lot of money per play on a song. So recouping the costs of a song takes a very long time, and one has to spend a lot of money in terms of marketing to recoup any costs. All right, let's maybe perhaps move on to... Sorry, I lost my place. oh, that's also another point I wanted to make. Recouping the royalties or digital online earnings can take a long time. Often the reporting, so I work through a content, what they call a DSP, a digital service provider based in the States, and they have to wait for all the various online platforms to submit their data, and then once they've submitted their data, which is sometimes months late, then I get told where my song has been played and how much I've earned, and then I can get the money therefrom. So the cash flow is not exactly, it's not like my song was played and then I've got money in my account the next day. So let's move on to, can we go back a little bit? There we go. Thank you so much. The idea of control, the artist control. So some of the works, I play classical violin as part of my online persona, and some of these videos were made as educational for people. And so here I'm starting to allude to the idea of fair use and perhaps how it could be extended or not extended, or how I understand it to be used. And I'm open to questioning or to hear what your views are. Making educational content available is fairly easy on online platforms. So what I had done is I'd made separate videos available for free to members who wanted to submit an email or take a survey for that content. And I've seen that many other online creators do something similar. So there's a lot of free content actually available, very good free content available. Often to make it viable for the creator, they have some content available behind a paywall. Obviously, they've got to recoup their costs, and they can deem that as necessary for them to make their costs back. But just to say that educational content is easy to make freely available to people. And I think what I'm kind of driving at is that the artist, I think many people in my position feel that the artist should have some control in how that is made available. And many are open to making that available. They just want to be able to control it, or perhaps have a mechanism like, can you take a survey, or can you give me an email address, or something along those lines. So that's the one aspect of taking control. I guess also in that regard is the creator of the content also has the choice in what they choose to monetize and what they choose not to monetize. I've also seen content creators who have work that's behind a paywall, but they will make a portion of it available for free in a very casual manner, so it was easy for them to make. Maybe it's on their cell phone, and they'll put it out to people on their mailing list. So, yeah, I think I'm not sure. I caught the tail end of the previous discussion, and I think access to information. I do get that there are some challenges and there is a digital divide, but for those who have access to online platforms, there is a vast amount of information available freely to many people. Then there's the aspect in terms of control of permission to how a work is used. So I guess I've dealt with sort of monetization, and now to deal with how it is used. So I think there's also the concern amongst some creators that their work may be used in a context that doesn't support their views, their values, their context. It could be taken, they could be aligned with a cause that they perhaps don't support through the introduction of fair use. And I think artists would like to, again, have control of how their work is used. And I guess many would like to just have the opportunity to have their consent, I think, given. I think it feels like the artist's consent has been eroded and taken away by the fair use clause. Just a note on that. Personally, I've had to request permission to use content, and vice versa, I've had someone request permission from myself. Also, very easy in an age of social media platforms and websites, it's very easy to find a publisher or somebody that you can request permission from. So, it just kind of feels like consent should be something that is still kept, and that both parties can reasonably request permission for how a work is used. And if an artist disagrees, especially if it is contrary to how they want to be perceived as an artist or their work, there should be some space for them to have that view recognized. All right, then we can move on to the next slide, which is the burdens of the amendments. So the first one I wanted to speak about is as I understand the introduction of fair use, there is the three-step test that they, or a test of how a work is used. But it's not like, as I understand it, it's not that consent has been requested from the artist. So what that would do is it places a burden in terms of the artist trying to find where their works are being used and how. So currently, artists have an idea of in terms of fair dealing, how much of their work is possibly being used in terms of education or criticism and those kinds of avenues. But as I understand it, in terms of some of the readings that I've done, it would make it put the onus on the artist to find places where the work is used, both in an online and an offline setting, and then to evaluate if their work has been used fairly or unfairly. And this is a huge task. Many artists have, for one song, it would be a great undertaking to have a body of work out there. You would spend it's just impossible to find all the places that your song could be a derivative of or used in. And as a smaller operator, as a musician, it's just a time constraint that we cannot take on. And then similar to that, if you do find that your work has been used in a setting, I understand it that the artist would then, or the creator would then, the onus would be on the creator to take the matter to court to evaluate whether the instance has been fairly used or not. And I feel that would really be disadvantageous to creatives, because they're not they don't have budget for legal fees of this nature. And again, if you have one or two or three works out there with multiple uses in other settings that you haven't consented to, this really could add up. And I think many artists would just really couldn't support such an endeavor. So I'm not sure if there's a provision in some way that artists we'd be able to evaluate how their work is used without having to go to the courts, because it really would be daunting and expensive for many, many artists. All right. Then we can move on to the next slide. So in addition to the reading that I did, I did go speak to somebody who is versed in legal matters, and they gave me some points that I could mention. So here we go. The point is that we do not have a system of punitive damages as the US does. There is therefore no disincentive to stop any parties from claiming fair use, as there is in the US. So that is my point as to who gets to claim to use your work in what setting. Another point they made was that the US has thousands of cases of fair use because that is what it is, a judge-made law. Thousands of court cases would be generated, and lawyers would make the money, and the artists would be disincentivized and prejudiced. So this is now just coming from the legal person that I spoke to. I'm not sure of the section of the copyright myself, but their point was that the proponents of fair use claim that it is necessary to future-proof our law in respect of rapidly changing technology, yet our current Section 13 of Copyright Act enables the minister to pass regulations to do just that. Right, and then I'm happy to move on to a conclusion, which is the next slide. Thank you. So in conclusion, I think many creatives and artists, up-and-coming small operators, hopefuls, people wanting to go into music, welcome an update in terms of technology and a copyright law that would fit in with the modern world. However, there are concerns as to what it will do to their creative rights and I think the motivations for them to create, to continue to create material. I think artists would like to continue some control over how their works are used and monetized. I think artists that would like to have protection in terms of copyright of their works and would not want to have to go to court to defend their works unnecessarily. I wasn't quite sure. I think, like I said, I caught the tail end of the previous talk, but I did hear the gentleman mention something to do with if too much or too little has been used of a certain work, that is sort of more negligible. And I think from the perspective of a smaller operator, someone who's not signed to a record label, a small bit here or there really could add up in terms of, a musician making their career slowly. So I do think that needs to be borne in mind. Not all musicians are signed to record labels who maybe have budget to take on law cases. So I think, speaking for the smaller artists, I'd like to say that if an artist could actually earn more, and they're not because of it's deemed as negligible, then actually that artist is prejudiced. All right, I hope I've fairly represented my views to you, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Christelle, for the manner in which you have responded to our call to canvas this. For now, we don't have any views. We are in a process of canvassing views from the public, which definitely at the right time, we'll then, as a committee, having exhausted all all the views as expressed by those that indicated, and responded positive to our call, we will then be able to have a reflection as a committee, and then allow also the process to go to the House, and then the views of the House then will then be the final one, which will then be seconded to the President either to sign, or he might decide to do what he has done with the previous bill, send it back. But I think we value your views from your position. It was quite categorical. Let me just check from other members as well, that do they have any views that they want to converse with you. It looks like members are quite happy with your inputs. Let me then, on behalf of the members, take this opportunity to express a word of gratitude to the manner in which we're able to express the views of an independent artist, up and coming, as you have correctly pointed out, quite fascinating and exciting.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
The next presenter will be presentation from Mr. Ben Kersden. I guess he's the chairperson of the Red Create South Africa. Over to you, Mr. Ben Kersden.
Chairperson, unfortunately, I do not see Mr. Kersden on the platform. I have sent the organization, and I have tried to contact the organization just to establish where they are, because we have not received this presentation yet either. The presenter thereafter is the Western Cape Provincial Department of Economic Development. That individual was connected earlier on, but I think maybe due to load shedding, he has disconnected. But I've just been following up with him just to find out if he can't maybe start a little bit earlier in the absence of Mr. Kersden.
Okay. The Western Cape government, which I see is Mr. Benson and Kunu and Ms. Michelle Ellis. You said they were on the platform and then they disappeared.
Yes, yes. And I don't see them on the platform now, Chair. So I'm just following up with them just to find out where they are. Because we have asked that all presenters be in the meeting at least 1 hour before the start of the session. So they should be on the platform already. But let me just follow up with them. Apologies for the delay.
Okay, good. Great. Are we succeeding?
Chairperson, unfortunately, I am not able to get a hold of anybody. I'm still trying to contact the second numbers that we have. Just can you just please, can I maybe propose that we take a 10-minute break just so that we can resolve this, Chair? Because I'm struggling to get a hold of the people who are supposed to be on the platform.
All right. It's fine. Let's then have a 10-minute break and then resume after 10 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.